Hi everyone, this is Garvin here at Green Alpha. So we received some great feedback about my comments at the Advisor Summit after the SRI conference, so we're resharing what we said there so we can keep the conversation going. We're always happy to discuss next economy investing with any and all advisors, so please feel free to reach out with questions or with feedback. We're always excited to hear from you. So my comments that morning were that here at Green Alpha, we call our thesis Next Economics and its practical application Next Economy Portfolio Theory. So, of course, there's already classical economics and there's already modern portfolio theory, so it's reasonable to ask why we wanted to develop a new approach. So, why Next Economics? Well, because the world is changing rapidly, perhaps more so than at any time in human history, and it's happening in two key ways. The first way is risks. We can see today that most of our big risks, resource degradation and scarcity, health and mortality risks, inequality, security issues, climate disruption, these are all connected and they exacerbate one another. The World Economic Forum always does a good job summarizing these in its annual Global Risks Report. This year they said, quote, "The urgency of facing up to systemic challenges has intensified over the past year amid proliferating signs of uncertainty, instability, and fragility." Well, exactly. And in all the 45 million centuries of history, this century that we're living in may turn out to be one of the most important and one of the most momentous. So in the face of that, here in the portfolio management industry, we still use an economic framework from the 19th and 20th centuries, when many of these risks were either less evident or less understood. So with risks multiplying and snowballing, we thought we need a new, more comprehensive thesis that addresses the full spectrum of risks to be able to address that in time. The second reason we thought we needed a new framework of portfolio management is that innovation and technological advancement are accelerating too, seemingly, maybe, as fast as our risks, meaning our ability to manage risk is improving at just the right time in history. It turns out we do have one inexhaustible resource, and that is human innovation. If that might sound a little pie in the sky, just think of all the things that didn't exist 10 years ago. There's hundreds of examples, of course, but just, say, in mobile communications, the distance in time between an analog flip phone that looks like it might have been waiting for a DOS prompt and an iPhone 10 with face recognition and a retina display was under 10 years. When we think about how abrupt innovation can be, I think it's worth remembering. In 1943, Oppenheimer didn't think science was going to pull off a controlled nuclear reaction for 50 years, but he succeeded 2 years later. The Wright brothers predicted man flight wouldn't happen for 50 years, 2 years before they pulled that off. In our own time, tech innovation isn't all just smartphones and video games, of course. It's about using data to make a more efficient economy, one where every resource is maximized. For example, in the agriculture industry, they rely heavily on water, which is a diminishing resource that is further threatened by the warming climate and resulting shifts in precipitation patterns. Simultaneously, companies are rushing to create tech that dramatically improves water efficiency and things like indoor farming, which use far less water to start with. So by developing measurement, management, and treatment technologies, companies are maximizing every valuable drop. So investment today has to be innovation-facing. And those innovations had better be doing something to lower the economy's overall risk profile. Notice I don't say a portfolio's risk profile, not the same thing. So we developed a new framework for investing because of this confluence, because risks and solutions are peaking together and they're doing it today. So that's why Next Economics, but what is the next economy? Well, in short, the next economy is a sustainable, low-carbon economy that is hyper-efficient, productive, it's innovative, and it's very much tech-leveraged. So yes, this does include renewable energy, and the transition to renewables is how we're going to power the economy from here forward, but it's also very much about how leveraging efficiency-driven technologies has the power to drastically reduce humanity's stress on our ecological underpinnings. So as biologist E.O. Wilson has said, quote, why would I be optimistic that the digital world is going to shrink humanity's ecological footprint? That's the nature of economic evolution, that people want and they will select, if they have any choice, instruments and material goods that are smaller, consume less energy and material, and need to be fixed less frequently, and all of that means that ecological footprint is destined to shrink, end quote. It may be surprising to many that E.O. Wilson would also turn out to be an economist, but he's right. He's saying that via innovation, we get more economic outputs, more stuff, out of fewer and fewer inputs. That creates wealth, of course. It's always been the key wealth driver in civilization, but it also greatly shrinks our ecological footprint, so it's a win-win. It also means we have a chance to provide a good standard of living for the 100% without crossing any more planetary boundaries. In other words, colliding with our big systemic risks. In addition, we don't believe that solving our huge system-level risks has to mean an end to economic growth. On the contrary, we need to apply economic growth quickly and in the right areas to ensure solutions are deployed at scale and at a speed commensurate with the problems we now face. So, economic growth doesn't have to mean using more stuff and crashing through planetary boundaries. On the contrary, economic growth can simply mean doing things better, far better. So, what does an economy that has defused all these interconnected risks look like? What can it look like? Well, we believe the next economy rests on four pillars. One, massive productivity gains, as presaged by Wilson, powered by two, indefinite renewables, importantly, the sourcing of materials nearly exclusively from the third pillar, waste-to-value economics, as opposed to sourcing our material from primary geological resources. And then finally, four, characterized by far more equitable ownership of these fantastic new means of production as a way of reducing inequality, which itself, of course, is an existential risk. So that's how we can de-risk the world while growing the economy and even creating abundance. So to get there, we need to think about our endgame. We think investing in companies building this world is paramount. It may sound surprising, but every sector and industry is subsumed within these four pillars of the next economy, which again are massive productivity gains, indefinite use of renewables, waste to value as means of sourcing material, and equitable ownership of the means of production. So to recap, we have all these problems, and the economy is quickly evolving to address them, but how does that translate into stock selection? That's the next obvious question for us. Well, we believe you have to start with a blank slate and build up, as opposed to starting with an index and screening down. So it's key to start by understanding, again, what the end game will be. For us, that's a de-risked economy, and then figuring out how to get there. To do that, in turn, we need an understanding of what's currently preventing a fully realized de-risked economy. So we go back to schemes like the World Economic Forum's papers on interdependent risks, which really is the center of imagining a way forward, and it's the beginning of our process. So understanding our big risks, we then can begin to think about what may mitigate those in terms of innovation, business practices, new techs. So that's the second step. What will provide the means to reduce risks? In our third step, starting to have some understanding of the means of risk reduction, we think next about not only productivity and risk mitigation, but now business models. What can be deployed fast? What can be deployed at scale and to the benefit of its owners? In other words, the risk mitigating technique or technology or approach has to be scalable, it has to work, and it has to have a business model that works to the profit of its beneficial owners. Again, ideally, a far greater portion of its workers and population in general. So finally, in our fourth step, assimilating all of the above, we can start to arrive at a list of companies that are leading the way in these areas, and which companies we can then assess for fundamentals, valuation, and general investment worthiness. So very much starting from a blank slate and building up a list, as opposed to starting with an index and arriving at a smaller list. And this is important. To do this, we have to recognize that modern portfolio theory, again, developed in the 50s when none of our present changes were yet evident, requires us to define risk as correlation with or deviation from a benchmark. So modern portfolio theory says that the risk in a portfolio is defined as the summation of the correlation between the past price movements of the assets in the portfolio. MPT, then, is an effort to manage portfolio construction to minimize risk, but its definition of risk is purely internal to its correlation to the benchmark and to nothing else. So how deeply is this definition of risk entrenched? Well, very. To the extent that a modern portfolio theory textbook indicates that about 91% of a manager's portfolio returns should be driven by asset allocation in order to mimic the asset allocation of the benchmark, and only 5% of returns should be driven by decisions involving what a company actually does. A lot of managers manage this way because failing to have low tracking error is punished in many institutions, such as having a star deducted on Morningstar or being classified as having low risk adjusted returns, no matter how good the absolute performance may be. So, even active managers feel the need to correlate, and there's a nearly universal belief that has resulted that therefore indexing is the best way to invest in public markets. Because by buying the index itself, you obviously have perfect correlation with the index and therefore definitionally have removed all risk. I think we all know that that's not true. So this belief is so widespread that even managers trying to reflect a sustainable economy end up trying to modify an index into something more green. But the best you can do there is really earn green beta, meaning you can't really seek alpha, nor can you as meaningfully address our real risks. You're still correlated with the causes of risk. So low tracking error is the holy grail in equity management, and yet we all know there are way more significant risks across the economy and, consequently, to one's portfolio than whether you correlate with your benchmark. Like, for example, the IPCC a little while ago warning us that we've got maybe 12 years to reverse course on climate disruption. So the problem with the MPT definition of risk is that it requires us to remain correlated with a bench, which in turn reflects the old economy, and therefore means many investors remain correlated with dozens of fossil fuel companies, producers of things like hydrogenated oils and high fructose corn syrup, and the inventors and sellers of dangerous pesticides like glyphosate, Roundup, to name only a few of the big risk causes that staying correlated with the index keeps you correlated with, even if you're not directly invested in those companies. So not only is staying correlated with that not reflective of actual risk on the ground in the world today, it doesn't even represent good diversification, as it turns out. You all will be familiar with Harry Markowitz, the popularizer of modern portfolio theory, again in the 50s. In his white paper, Can You Do Well by Doing Good Part 2, he wrote something interesting. He wrote, quote, "Diversification does reduce risk, but it has a severely limited ability to do so in the face of correlated risks. Portfolio volatility could be driven as close to zero as you want with sufficient diversification if returns were uncorrelated, but they are not." Unquote. In casual parlance, Markowitz to me seems to be saying, hey, guys, when I said you should diversify your investments, I didn't mean to diversify them among a bunch of highly correlated assets. We would add to Markowitz's comments that you do have to question the returns of any strategy that look just like the index, but say that they're seeking alpha. So if we want to invest in the next economy and de-risk our portfolios from systemic risks like resource degradation and climate disruption, how do you make portfolio choices if not by mirroring a bench? Well, not by selecting solely from an index list. Recognizing that the old rules are partially responsible for getting us into this mess, we decided to advance portfolio theory, evolve it, to proceed from first principles instead of from portfolio theory. First principles requires us to evaluate the world as it is and act accordingly. So, understanding the interconnectivity of risks, combined with leveraging the powerful innovations emerging now that can address those risks, has led us to the previously described four pillars of the next economy. Again, massive productivity gains, powered by renewable energies, supplied via waste to value, and more equitably owned, which represents an economy that could become able to thrive indefinitely, which, again, is our actual endgame. Again, not correlation. So to invest only in the components of this next economy requires us to think less like public equity managers in the traditional sense, and more like private equity managers. In other words, to seek out what's going to work, what can grow at scale, what can address a largely unmet need, and to do so in an innovative way that disrupts its predecessor, such as wind disrupting coal, for example, and with a business model that rewards its owners. with no correlation required or even really considered. In short, it means investing in things that will work indefinitely without crashing us into large-scale risk while gaining market share away from their legacy economy predecessors. Well, the quickest way to figure that out among public equities today is to observe where a firm is earning the majority of its money. Put simply, expressed as a function of revenues, a company has to be doing more to solve systemic risk than it is doing to cause it. Seeing where a company is getting paid is the clearest line of sight here. We think it's wise to start with a top-down thesis revolving around what a company actually does and how it gets paid. Only then, within that, can one contemplate ESG criteria. Because if a manager starts with ESG scores, this can result in a portfolio of companies that have good ESG scores but are nevertheless the causes of big systemic risk. A fossil fuels company, may have great employee stock ownership plan, but it's still a fossil fuel company responsible for the causes of climate disruption. So in terms of portfolio construction, we're required to be forward-looking, where indices and correlation are by definition backward-looking. Remember, you can't keep correlating with what was and have appropriate portfolio exposure to what's next, to what's solving our big problems. So that's why MPT both keeps us invested in the legacy economy and limits our exposure to what's next. If risk is defined by backward-looking data, then investing in what's next on a forward-looking basis may be labeled risky, but in fact, it's not. It's the most existentially conservative way to invest, and therefore, the most likely to result in long-term competitive performance. If managers and advisors fall into the trap that it doesn't matter what a company does as long as it has decent ESG scores, they're only seeing part of the story. This matters for returns because the tailwinds for a business won't be there if the company isn't doing something to change the economy's risk profile. Not a portfolio's risk profile as measured by correlation, but the actual underlying economy's risk profile. This will be the driver of long-term returns. We're taught to correlate with the S&P 500 because we want to get rid of uncertainty. But of course, it is impossible to get rid of uncertainty. All an investor is doing by correlating with the SPX is experiencing the same uncertain outcomes as everyone else, which might make us feel a little better, but it's actually no less uncertain. So what you'll see in Green Alpha strategies is, yes, general equities correlation, of course, but that's about it. Apart from that, you're going to have a hard time recognizing long-term correlation with a major established benchmark. But what you will see is favorable characteristics. The part of the old rule book that remains very relevant is intrinsic value, is fundamentals, which, because of first principles, we do believe will matter again in the markets and in the long time frame, will remain the most important driver of equity returns when combined with identification of companies participating in the next economy. So you'll see, for example, that our average portfolio level intrinsic valuation versus price, as measured by price-to-book ratio, is cheaper than SPX on a portfolio-level number. You'll see that the average revenue growth rate is far higher because innovation is stealing market share, and you'll see far lower average long-term debt levels than SPX. So what we're putting together are portfolios that offer more growth at a cheaper price with less debt and all invested in companies focused on mitigating real-world risks and bringing the innovation. This is only possible because we have about a 97% active share versus SPX, indicating the next economy approach of not correlating with the incumbent economy. So that's the essence of next economy portfolio theory, and it's what we've practiced for, well, coming up 10 years on December 30th. We've been doing that with a very consistent process. We've never had any style drift, which is backed up by the fact that we've always had really low turnover. So, for example, we've always been fossil fuels free because, again, first principles. The cause of our largest risk, by definition, makes a terrible long-term investment. Never having held fossil fuels, we never did have to divest. The solution to green beta is the private equity approach to public equities. To make sure every holding is addressing at least one, and preferably more, of our big systemic risks, and that holding is contributing to at least one, and preferably more, pillar of the next economy. Because it turns out that it's not portfolio theory, but the economy itself that is the source of forward investment risk. So we asked the question, should our goal, therefore, not be to realize a zero-risk portfolio, which is impossible in any case, but rather to realize a zero-risk economy? And can we not, via our investments, be a conduit of capital to that ideal and thus self-actualize the de-risking of the economy and therefore earn the benefits that come from gaining all the market share? That is where Green Alpha thinks we're going, and that's how we build our strategies for you all. Again, thank you. We appreciate you using Green Alpha and keeping us in mind for your clients. And we are, again, more than happy to entertain any discussion or answer any questions. So never hesitate to reach out. We're always here. Thanks, everyone.